is the house. And I'm raising these orders on the lower 34 on Thursday, March 2022. Members present are Representative Scott, New Jersey State Story, and myself, Ms. Bonds, let the record reflect that I'm required to conduct business in Sellersville, according to Secretary's of the Attorney, or Elliot, or whatever, but which is joining us this morning.
Information to for our purposes and for our purposes, we started out back down and was largely kept to is that we do our forecast based on spending patterns that are different for men and women, so for male and female, for Alaska Native and non-Native. And the point is there is, well, spending patterns don't differ much. The federal financial participation rates can be very different for Alaska Native services when they're done at a IHS facility and for other services also. So it's important to differentiate those populations from the forecast. We also spent 12 different age cohorts, and as you can imagine, the healthcare needs differ very much based on age. So that ends up with 48 different demographic groups that we focus on and care about. And then we kind of further by looking at those 48 demographic groups for 5 different regions of the state. So at the end of this, we end up with essentially micro forecasts of 240 different groups within the state. So that matters because the health rates differ, the health payment, the federal participation, how it is done, it differs also. So that allows us to control the price. So that's our population. Next, we have the enrollment. So historically, in the picture, the rates of participation in the Medicaid program differ by a lot of different factors. And a lot of those are just mentioned there, by age, by gender, by region of the state. So we're able to project the likelihood of each individual in Alaska, the likelihood of being on the Medicaid program in any given year in the future, again, just a projection. Step three, our first steps here, the utilization of services. For our purposes, we think utilization has how many different service categories in individual uses. And so we look at 21 different service categories in Medicaid, and these are could be physician services, outpatient hospital transportation. So these are each one is of course a collection of many, many, many different individual services, but in the service group. So how many different services the individual is using? And this is important because we found from back to just before 2000, the typical enrollee was only using about 2.1 of these different services per year. And today, it's closer to 3 services, or just over 3 services per year. So, as the Medicaid program has aged, so has, comfort level of enrollees to use different services. Next step is adjusting Medicaid services. And so that differs from utilization in that it is a measure of technical change. So are people moving from our healthcare providers moving from doing a typical X-ray to doing CT scans? Are there therapeutics available? Are there other type of therapies that are available also? So that's intensity of Medicaid services. And then finally, step 5 is we bring this all together for spending on Medicaid. So this is the place that we also bring in. Inflation of Medicaid, or inflation of healthcare overall, this is where we factor in changes in prices. In our cases, reimbursement rates, but essentially prices for Medicaid services. Next slide, please. If you have questions, I'm happy to take any questions as they come up. So before we get into the forecast per se, this slide, I think, is a really good illustration of the incredible heterogeneous changes that have happened in the Medicaid program over the last decade. So looking from 2012 through 2011, somewhat small chart here, but where the bars represent total spending on Medicaid. The blue portion of each bar is state spending, so general fund spending. The red is the federal portion. And to just start with that part, the state portion, between 2012 to 2021, fiscal year 2012, fiscal year 2021, spending is about the same as it was. So, and of course, that has to do more with federal policy than anything else. But from the state's perspective, from a budgetary perspective, spending hasn't changed that much. So that has to be the one thing that hasn't changed much. For overall spending, so the federal portion has changed dramatically. And of course, the expansion is a big part of this. The ACA overall is part of this also. So even as the spending on Medicaid has changed quite a bit, has grown quite a bit, the state portion of this has really not changed at all. And then the two lines, so the blue line and the green line. So the green line first, this represents enrollment in the Medicaid program. And in 2012, it was about 150,000 persons enrolled. At any given time, you see the projected count of enrollment in 2012. So that could be an individual who's enrolled 12, 12 months, not just for 2012, or they could be enrolled for just 1 month. So it's, if they're enrolled for 11, they're enrolled in 2012. So they grew from 150 in 2012 to 265,000 approximately in fiscal year 2021. So a large increase. The blue line are recipients. And so really important to differentiate enrollees from recipients. Enrollees just means you're on the rolls, you're enrolled in the program. Recipients is a measure of did you actually use services. And so in 2012, with 150,000 enrollees in the Medicaid program, there were 132,000 recipients. And as you can see, the blue line has increased also, but not as much as the green. So in 2021, with 265,000 people on Medicaid, there were fewer than 200,000 actual recipients of services in Medicaid. So that has a couple of reasons why it's like that. It started diverging to some degree with components of the ACA, but then also in the last couple of years, the mandate from the federal government that with the COVID emergency that the only way someone could come off of Medicaid would be if they lived out of state or they died. So, or they passed to be removed from it. So there isn't that same traditional process that is clean and well.
General fund spending on Medicaid decreased by nearly 12%, and that's why we're insuring about another 65,000 Alaskans roughly during that time. So I think that's really notable, and that was in part because of the Affordable Care Act passing and the state's expanding Medicaid, and the combination of those states allowed for an increase in the number of folks that were eligible for Medicaid, but also increased reimbursement rate by the federal government for that expanded population at the same time. So, I think from a healthcare policy standpoint, that's pretty exciting, but from this committee's perspective, it's also important because our job is to control state spending in Alaska, and we've actually reduced our general fund spend by nearly 12% during this time frame. Representative Stratton.
Thank you. So, when the total spend does the state control and I think it's probably just pretty much on the slightly, but to what extent does the state control the burden on our funds from Medicaid? I mean, the direct part of it is indeed to create the number of employees and recipients increase, but I mean, are we to some extent just about the mercy of the federal government and to what extent provided federal funds, or can you expand on that altogether? Thank you.
Sure. There are definitely on this call also individuals who understand the financing, federal financing part of this, but in a nutshell, showed that our problem with Medicaid is a little over right now, it's 56.5%, I believe, for an individual who is enrolled in Medicaid through expansion. 90% is paid by the feds. For those that are enrolled through expansion are less than that. So there are essentially for the IHS expansion, that's 100% federal. Other IHS plus 100% federal spending. And then there's also there's other smaller groups that are for young people under 20 that are in the CHIP program, so they should get charge part right now. And so that's 65%, and I think that's also boosted right now with the COVID epidemic. So it varies, as you mentioned, it varies by federal policy.
Next question.
Yes, thank you. I'm Medicare. I just submit quick stamps.com.
position it's going to be in. And it's not really that, I can't remember how many years ago, but just general categories and how many years special needs, at least there was just a quick sort of breakdown, and I'll do it for that again.
The
information about the analysis we got.
The doctor came across that information. Touch thumbs up. We'll get to a picture of that.
Right.
We want to get in. We think the report is actually number of numbers.
Right. We'll have a look at that. Thanks so much. All right. Go ahead.
All right. So, next slide, please. Okay. So, let's start with that. Start step one. So, population. And there's a couple slides in here where it kind of gives the long view, so the historical view is part of this, as well as the future. So in this slide, the blue bars represent the population of Alaska, and the red line represents the growth rate, the annual growth rate in the population. And so we start from a very low base, from 1950, so just to make a statement, to today and then in the future. As you can see, obviously the population of Alaska grew. It has not grown nearly as fast in the last decade, last couple decades, and it's going to continue to grow slowly into the future. And this is, again, based on the state's demographer projection. This allows us to know the Medicaid program. There's a bit of a governor on this. There's a bit of a cap on how many people actually get enrolled in Medicaid. And that this lower population growth, will continue to result in a less favorable, lower growth in Medicaid program moving forward. And next slide, please. So, saying that, there's also demographics. And so, as population has slowed, population growth has slowed considerably over the last couple of decades and will continue to slow, what that population looks like is going to change also. And so, between 2022 and 2024, the state projects the population is going to grow by less than 0.5% per year. But the rate of growth for seniors, 65 plus, is going to be a little over 1%, whereas for working age adults, that's maybe not the best term anymore, but adults 20 to 64 will be growing at about one-third of that rate, at 0.35%. And children, the growth in children is going to be about 0.2%, so very slow growth in the future. And so, has a big impact on the burden. And I think most of you can imagine what that's going to be. But let's go to the next slide and start seeing that. And so, again, another long view on the Medicaid. So, going from fiscal year 97 to today, and then to 2042, the rule of the phrase, and I heard this, and so I use it, I think I use it in the report at least once or twice, is that Medicaid once was a program that really focused on children. Today, it's a program that focused much more on adults. And that really happened big with expansion. In the future, the seniors, while they are a small relative number or proportion of the Medicaid program, they're growing more rapidly, just like the seniors are growing at a rapid rate in the population, and their health care needs are different than others. All right, on to the next slide, please.
Breakdown, such as how many receive services because of the disabled
There is at least one table in the appendix that has enrollment, the professional enrollment by different eligibility categories, which would include several that are focused on disabilities, but those aren't broken out by age. That said, my guess is the majority would be of adults kind of 64. So there are certainly, and there's also data that are available, so that's something that's of interest that you'd like that. I can get back to the party to get to you.
Yeah, that would be helpful. And I think actually, I'm wondering if Ms. Gayhart might address the question of design expectation meeting at the top of her head or have it up her head. Ms. Gayhart.
Yeah. So it is, it's not their, it isn't a case of, what's going on, you're going to stay on, so people do get to turn out, turn through the program, and they come on at a different time, but then there's so.
Thank you.
but it doesn't visually, you can't see 60% vote on this far. I can't see 60% vote on this way. Am I looking at the wrong spot? Or is it any other?
That's a different dialogue. We're saying that the 6% vote is the agreement that the federal government is paying to assemble. We're looking at how this slide is in a moment. Does that make sense?
I misunderstood what you're saying. I thought you said that there was a 6%.
He said it was a federal, but he said increasing that the federal government was paying us in a high Medicaid services, not the number of people on Medicaid.
Okay, very good.
Okay. All right, great. And it was that noting you kind of want to make sure we got through Dr. Helbert's entire presentation and also to Ms. Reese's presentation. So I'm going to move along at this point in time.
Thank you. Our next slide, please. So, from enrollment in Medicaid to something maybe more important, medical cost inflation, the Medicaid rate versus reimbursement rates, so growth and reimbursement rates. So, our next long term view, so population long term view, enrollment long term view, and reimbursement rates and reimbursement inflation long term view. From 2005 to the present, and then projected in the future. Some of the red lines. So the red line represents the medical cost inflation from the increase over the CPI index. So the red bullet, the red solid line is historical data, and then the dashed data is a forecast in the future. The blue solid line is growth in reimbursement rates for Medicaid services. And this is, the red line comes from the feds, from BLS, from government statistics. The blue line I came up with based on analysis of reimbursement data, year-over-year reimbursement data from the department. And these reimbursements, this growth of reimbursement rates, much slower than medical price inflation. This incorporates reimbursement rates for hospital care, personal care attendants, transportation services, physician services, psychologists, and other types of behavioral type services. So the takeaway is that the reimbursement rates in the department are much slower than overall medical price inflation in Alaska. Then the blue area is the projection of with such areas, projection of what reimbursement rates are going to look like in the future. And so my personal opinion is that it will likely, it's not going to be the bottom of that band or that area, but it's still not going to be top either. It's going to be, my guess is somewhere in the lower half of that. So reimbursement rates have to increase. The price is going up for providers, and so they're going to demand higher reimbursement rates. Based on historical ability of the department to hold down costs, my assumption is that it's going to be below that.
Sure.
Yeah, so for purposes of using the CPI, there's also the PCE, which is typically a little bit lower. So for the CPI, we're looking at around 4% per year, 4 or 5% per year increase. And so, like, maybe today that seems kind of low compared to what inflation is coming in at the moment, but by historical standards, that was well above general cost inflation. I don't really have a feel at this point for my guess would be that medical price inflation is actually going to be a little under general cost inflation for the next little while. But I don't know if that's necessarily the case. So it has been 4 to 5 in the last few years. That was way above general price inflation. But I don't think it is going to stay that
pretty high, and so sort of comparatively it'll be lower, or is it really because healthcare cost growth is slowing down?
Probably Medicaid makes the most, but probably more than before. So, so much of the kind of question that's right now is driven by food allergy and by some supply chain constraints, by monetary policy, I think many would say. So, those are going to affect the demand of consumers for lots of things. For medical services, which may be even more expensive for other reasons, I think that they're going to stay kind of at trend, or my forecast actually, although it doesn't seem that way, the forecast for medical care inflation is slightly lower than what we've seen in the last few years.
All right, what do you think is going to be driving what your thinking with regard to why you think medical care, healthcare cost inflation will be slower than coming years than it has been?
Yeah, good question. As much as anything, it's the, I guess, kind of reverting to the mean. And so, if you look at the historical from 2005 to today, it was lower in Alaska through 2016, 2017. That sped up. And this is especially if the hypothesis of reversion to the mean. So, that would, if anything, would bring it down.
Okay, thank you.
Next slide, please. This slide, I think, is a bias for audience that health care prices differ by age and recipient. And this slide, children, adults 30 to 64, and seniors, and five different points in time from 2018 to Corpus per year, up to 2042, spending today. The typical recipient with a senior is around just over $20,000. For a child, it's around $8,000. And I'm going to say again that issue of enrollee versus a recipient. So the data shows graph for only recipients. So there are tens of thousands, probably 60,000 to 70,000 Medicaid enrollees right now that are not using services at all. This graph is up. So, in other words, I'm zero. So, we are not out of 10. This is only going to those that actually are using services, which is probably a fair way to look at the program, just because of the distortion associated with enrollment. So, this slide is, I think, one of the ways that is critical of the first way to think about with the program, the levers that drive costs in this program. So I'm starting to about that report, and again, on the previous year of 2014, the blue bar at the bottom is essentially what would the state run the program costs if everyone's on the program, the state on the program, no other people came on the program, and everybody stayed the same age. So in other words, nothing changed in the program. It's in the status quo. So we're starting with a base of about $2.3 million. What can we do? So let's think about the population. And so the tan, very thin tan triangle on top of the blue, that's the increase in Medicaid spending. That's associated purely with just population growth. On top of that is, let me rephrase a little bit. Population growth and changes in population also, so that's a little bit of a factor of more scanners and such. The next thing, the one group above population growth, is the fact that my expectation is, because it just happens again and again and again and again, is that enrollment in Medicaid can grow a little faster than the population. And so that's the next part. So that's what the national has this next. So utilization of Medicaid services, that as people come to Medicaid, and I don't know if this is the case, but it's likely the case that when people do come to Medicaid, they stay longer, that there's maybe more, they're more educated about their options within the Medicaid program. And so the dark brown, the utilization of Medicaid services, assumption is that projection is that the number of services that an individual uses will continue to increase. So that they're going to touch more services. And that's going to make more higher spending. The light bulb above there, that's the Medicaid services. That's essentially a measure of changes in technology, medical technology, growth in the availability of different therapies and such, with medical and psychological. And then finally, I'm talking about the light red or rose color is growth in reimbursement rates. And clearly, that obviously looks like extreme growth right there, but that is compared to medical price inflation, that is relatively slow growth. So we assume instead that the reimbursement rates grow at the same rate as medical price inflation, we'd be probably up $7 billion by 2042. So the takeaway of this graph is that there are some aspects of the program that are without that population change. And what else then sort of what is it that part increased because of allowing us to attract more people to stay that in a good thing. So the number of folks that are potentially controlled by the department, by the legislature, and then those that are somewhat outside the control of the department. All right, question on that slide before we move on?
It's not working.
Okay, let's go to the next slide and just have a few more here. So, this is the third podcast that has been a large focus on contributions, and the chronic rate will be lower in the last few years, that were made more or less than I thought it could be in the last few years, and I don't know it, is that this. That healthcare in general in America, maybe around the world, most of the world anyway, is driven by populations. And so, in this first slide, this is there for looking at different age groups, and the number of people enrolled in Medicaid in each of those age groups, and then the number of those that do not have a diagnosed chronic condition, and those that do. And so, the blue is not a diagnosed chronic condition, the orange is a diagnosed chronic condition. For Canada, relatively few have a diagnosed chronic condition. As we move down there, the proportion of the age group with one or more diagnosed chronic conditions increases. And so, the massive big driver of the Imperium is what the numbers that I pulled out of this presentation, just to disarm it. It turns out that the spending, like the spending for a child without a chronic condition, and the spending for a senior, 65 or older senior on the Medicaid program, who does not have a chronic condition, are virtually the same. So again, spending on a child or spending on a senior, when neither one has a chronic condition, they're spending virtually the same. What the difference is that seniors tend to have more likely to have chronic conditions. As we get older, the ability to pick up more chronic conditions increases, and so the fact spending on seniors seems to be interrelated, but it's really chronic conditions. The takeaway, let's go to the next slide, is that today, 80% of all the spending on the Medicaid program are for those with a chronic condition. And over the last 3 years now, actually, 2018, 2019, 2020, 2021, I've looked at this. The number of people in the program for diagnosed chronic condition has been virtually unchanged, which is really, probably, from a data scientist point of view, or from a balance point of view, to look at data, and my expectation would be for cutting errors and stuff like this in general, that it's been incredibly stable, about 50,000 Medicaid recipients with one or more chronic conditions. So those 50,000 versus the entire Medicaid population are using the Medicare services, and that's sort of going to be to Medicaid. So by 2042, it's been just by demographics alone, is that's going to be 84% of the spending on the Medicaid program will be for those recipients with a chronic condition, with one or more diagnosed chronic conditions. Okay, so for our slides here, and so there may be very different tech now. So the blank focus of my presentation is to help on some ideas or some thoughts about how to control costs in the future. And I don't have any of this, but I hope that some of the information I'm sharing with you can tell you that this is something that people are thinking about, the people in the department are thinking about. So my first slide will be with the cost curve. And so it is the thread, they're all about the same, but the red represents actual spending, the actual history, and so in this case, actual spending on the Medicaid program. And the blue dots represent the forecast that we then the legislature in 2006, and the red dash represents the most recent forecast that we're going to talk about today. And so the big takeaway here is when we first presented the forecast in 2006, legislature, the spending for the growth of spending in Medicaid program was about 15% a year, 15-20% a year. So amazingly fast, really. After that, the changes implemented by the department, pushed by the legislature, resulted in relatively much slower spending growth. And the forecast as well, definitely not forecast of increased spending, it is much lower than what the original forecast. So I'll just go to the next slide, please. And well, the first slide was with about spending. This is about recipients of Medicaid services. So again, the red line represents actual recipients of Medicaid services. The blue dot represents the projected number of persons receiving Medicaid services. And then the blue dash is the current forecast. And in this case, the end up for until Medicaid expansion, it was very close, the forecast versus the actual number of recipients. With expansion increased quite a bit, and the number of recipients would continue to increase, but it continued to increase and decrease year round. So, relatively modest increase in recipients relative to what we've seen in the past. So, first line we looked at, does no Medicaid, what's no Medicaid projected? This line we looked at the number of recipients waiting in terms of many more than expected. So then our last slide is the spending per recipient. Red N represents actual spending per recipient. The blue dash represents the projected spending per recipient. Given the conditions at the time, given the different forecast from the state with respect to population and with respect to the way reimbursement rates were for services were done. And then the green dash is our projection this time. And so the big takeaway is that the overall spending is much lower than projected. And while the state government recipients are limited, we're earning more. And so the only way that can happen is that the spending per recipient is dramatically lower than we projected in the original forecast. And again, I'm going back to that first thing slide where the reason for this, well, the primary reason for this is as a baseline. So you see, if you need to change the program, how does it affect things? And while I'm not going to try to tell you that my original forecast was right, would have been right, it did provide a statistically based projection of spending given the conditions. So they don't provide a base for comparing the ability to bend the cost curve.
All right, Dr. Hewitt, I've got a couple of questions. I just want to clarify that the actual spend per person here is the total spend, including both state and federal Medicaid funds. Yes, per person. All right, great, thank you. Representative Gustafson.
For example, a typical beneficiary costing maybe $13,000 or something. That's the average. I mean, there must be a lot of people that get to become a goal and stubborn, they see someone, and then they stop or they push their own goal and their charges are $1,000. Correct?
Absolutely. And can just take this up for you. If you separate the Medicaid recipients between those that have one or more conditions and those that have been meeting recipients, so they're receiving services, not so that they're not receiving services. Those that are on Medicaid receiving services but do not have one or more diagnosed chronic conditions, their spend is about $3,500 on average across all age groups, about $3,500 per year. And as you mentioned, that would range from very low, in the hundreds, to something much higher than that, but the average across age groups, those are the conditions, $3,500.
Now, earlier, in the presentation, Dr. Hewitt said essentially that 50,000 people are about 20% of the total Medicaid population, and so they're responsible for about 80% of the spend on those folks that have chronic, one or more chronic conditions. That's one of the reasons that some of the most effective Medicaid reform strategies really have to be about helping people to get health care so that we can reduce our spend, because the most expensive person to provide care for is a really sick person, and it's a lot less expensive to spend money for a healthier person, and there are ways of reducing the acuity or severity of people's health. And those some of the most expensive conditions are diabetes and heart disease, for example. And so if we can kind of get upstream a little bit on some of those things, we can save a lot of money on the long run. Representative Shorty, do you have a question? Do you have anything else you want to add in closing, Dr. Hewitt?
Well, that's it. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you.
All right, thanks so much for your time and your presentation today. We really appreciate it. It was fully made. Right, next up, we're going to go to a presentation from the Department of Administration. We are from Emily Ricci and Betsy Wood. We're going to start with Emily Ricci. She's going to talk about Alaska Care. She's really going to be fluent. She's going to talk about the retirement health benefits. All right. this to you.
Starting to moderate a little bit, and the claims are starting to come down. You see much smaller spend, like
comes to inpatient facility. The pharmacy at Elbow Park is still considerably larger than it was in 2019 or 2018, and you're starting to see an increase in inpatient facility. And, you know, what we're seeing is that it's really spiked multiple times in 2020 for high-cost payments, followed by a drop in high-cost payments in 2021, but an overall increase in utilization of lower-cost services by members in 2021.
Before we move on, could you talk about the different number of lives that you were covering when you're talking about employees between FY17 and FY21? I think that's important given that our workforce is shrinking.
Yes, the employment demographics have actually remained fairly stable over the last 5 years in comparison, I think, to some of the other groups that we talked about. We've seen a slight decrease, so we don't have, on average, we don't quite have 16,000 members at this point. We're probably closer to the low 15,000 members overall, and that has been, that's reflective of attrition. And we're also starting to see the average age of the members of the employee plan drop. And I think that has to do with people retiring into our retirement plans. So we're seeing the age of the retiring plan increase, and we're seeing the age of the employee plan decrease.
So I guess that sounds, I just want to make sure I understand this properly. The total number of lives covered in the employee plan is decreasing slightly. The population that we're covering is younger. And we have fewer employees in the state of Alaska. I'm guessing that the reason that the number of total lives covered isn't decreasing is because they're younger and they're more dependent. Our employees are younger and have more dependents. Is that accurate?
I think we've seen some stability as far as the number of employees that are participating in positions that are covered under the last state there. And really, we're seeing an increase in, in the number of additional dependents on the plan. Many of the groups, maybe but not all of the groups that are covered under the last state care plan, particularly like the supervisory unions or others, tend to actually be towards the older range of the employee spectrum. They tend to be a little bit more stable. I think you probably tend to see more dependents on other collective bargaining units like TDU that's not covered under our health trust, where they may be entering the workforce and maybe they want to start having children.
Thanks.
So moving on to slide six. This is there's been a little bit of fun exciting this, but I really want to talk about 2020-2021 because I think this illustrates some of the trends that we've seen as a result of the utilization changes there. In 2018-2019, you can see each one of these bars represents essentially a different way to measure how services are being used, how much the plan is paying for different services, and how those are kind of annualized over population changes. So if you look at 2018 and 2019, you can see business as usual. You're seeing some, low single-digit percentage increases in your health care per month. Those are kind of under the national healthcare trend overall. You know, fee-for-service increases that remain relatively low. The number of services that are used for 1,000 people, so it's a way for you to have the average. The services average across the population remains fairly stable. Passes the amount paid. But with this 2020 new employee plan, things change very dramatically. And what we see is a tremendous increase in the paid per member per month per month, along with an increase in the pay per service. So we're paying more per member per month, and we're paying more for each service. But we're seeing a decrease in the overall services that are used by members. And to me, that aligns with the trends that we saw in 2020, which is we saw a number of very, very sick individuals that required very intensive medical care in 2020. So you see that spike in individuals who require high cost services. In 2021, we see the opposite. We see a drop in the amount paid on a per member per month basis. We see a decrease in the amount paid per service, and we see a sharp increase in the services that are utilized per thousand. So now what we're seeing in 2021 is we're seeing employees that have maybe put off care in 2020 coming back and starting to go and get their regular office visits, get their
those visits that they're last at. So you're seeing a higher number of lower cost service visits as people begin to utilize the program. So going back to the next slide, this is a slide that outlines what baseline utilization would be compared to what other benchmark plans experienced in the U.S. and then what the employee plan experienced in the U.S. relative to services used during the pandemic. And you can see the orange line on the bottom represents some kind of national benchmark plans, other people plans, and public employee plans in the U.S. And the dotted line is kind of what you might anticipate the typical trend to be in terms of utilization of services and cost of services. And you can see a drop in April and May, which is expected given everything that's going on in 2020 at that point, along with an increase back to the norm. Their retiree plan follows the same trend. What we see with that white line is the employee plan. And what you're seeing is a very large spike in claims in February, a decrease in April, but that decrease in April and May is higher. It's not as low as what we saw conventionally, and then you see a jump up again in June. So basically, the employee plan utilization in 2020 was different than what we're seeing both in the retiree plan and on an actual basis. Earlier in the year, we saw some use of novel gene therapies. We're going to talk about that later on in the slide, but there's some new cellular gene therapies coming out that provide tremendous, incredible therapeutic benefits to help, treat and cure diseases that have not been, curable before. They also cost a tremendous amount of money. They can range from, $600,000 to $2 million per treatment. So we did experience that in the employee plan earlier in the year, and that's why you see that spike in February. But then in June and later on in September and October, we had a tremendous number of very sick people using services in the state. In 2020, we had over 7 people with over $1 million in claims. This is highly unusual in the employee plan. I would have to go back a little bit. It's likely that somewhere is. Okay.
Thanks.
So looking at slide 8, all of these calls that come in the lines represent the figures. And so you can, claims, and again, we'll need this in terms of paid. Paid amounts on a per member basis over the calendar year. And so this is fairly typical in 2017 to 2019. We start to see claims in January, and then it's slowly see an increase through the end of the year as people start using services and get their deductible and following the drug basic health services done. But what we saw in 2020 again is just two very, very large and sustained claim spikes that are associated with high-cost claimants, both in the March, February-March period, as well as the September and October period. And I would note that this graph is paid claims versus incurred claims, and it's a small difference. There being incurred claims is when a claim is actually incurred, but paid claims is when a paid gets claimed. When a claim gets paid, there's a period of time between when person provides the service or facility provides the service, when they actually submit that service for reimbursement, when the claim goes through the system, and then when the check actually gets sent out. So if we were to compare this graph to the graph on slide 7, the last spike in February and the graph on slide 7 versus the spike in March here, and that's attributable to the difference in the claims incurred versus the claims paid.
So we can see that eventually probably percent of the patients incurred 80% of the cost. Is that similar in our employee pool as well?
Yes, and I would say that it is almost a little bit more skewed in the employee plan. They usually have closer to 5% of the plan management incurring around 20% of the cost. So it they are very much affected by the influence.
All right, thank you.
So, moving down to slide 9, some of the challenges we've faced in the last year, we've taken part in 2020, we've taken steps in 2021 to try to address that. The new gene therapies, this is a challenge that's going to face every health plan in the U.S. There might be maybe one of the first health plans. Diseases are directly, these therapies are, again, they provide incredible therapeutic benefits. They are extraordinarily expensive, and I think health plans are going to be challenged to figure out how to support and pay for these services in the future. One of the things that we've done is we've implemented a gene therapy network, and this is effective 2021. I apologize, I'm always year off. It should stay effective on 2022. So it's effective now. And essentially, what it does is it ensures that members are receiving these services or receiving them from the facility that is qualified to provide them and has agreed to member contracting. For example, Zolgensma is a therapy that costs anywhere from $2.1 to $2.7 million per treatment. And if the treatment is usually given at a member facility that does not have a contract with a provider, we have heard clinics coming in much higher than $2.7 million. So it's really essential for us and for our members if you're going to a provider that has a reimbursement rate that is contracted with us and, again, is qualified to provide these services. And not every facility in the U.S. at this point is qualified to provide these services. It depends on the type of therapy.
Like, what else will these gene therapies primarily used for?
Very rare genetic disorders. So there's a children's that is used for a type of infant spinal muscular atrophy disorder. There's a therapy called Luxturna that's used for a type of blindness, adrenal blindness. I think right now there are three that we are, that people are actively using, seeing claims for. But similar to specialty drugs or any new therapies, there's a series of additional gene therapies that we're working through the FDA approval process. And I anticipate you'll be hearing about this over the next 5 years as more of these become available.
All right, thank you.
We're also looking at stop loss coverage for gene therapy. There's a limit for our risk from a plan's perspective in terms of how much we pay for these services. Given our slightly high cost payments at the end of 2020, we went back and we were able to renegotiate inpatient facility costs with some of the hospitals in Anchorage as well as Madison. Those resulted in broader access for our members. So we have both Alaska Regional and Providence in our network again for our employee members. And they provided us with some better value for the services we were receiving. We are also addressing increasing pharmacy costs. We have been very challenged by pharmacy costs. We're going to talk about this more on the retiree plan side, but it's definitely impacting the employee's plan side, particularly the specialty medication. So we engaged in negotiating improved contract terms with our pharmacy benefit manager, Optum. We implemented a prescription drug formulary effective January 1, 2022 of this year. And we've established a pharmacy co-pay program that allows both members and the plan to benefit from some of the drug coupons that are available for specialty and brand medications.
All right, I have a question on this slide. Representative Jefferson.
Chair for this meeting. A couple of questions. The first is, does the state know if the employees are handled? As well as risk care, is there someone at the state who says, oh, those left out of the captain and the risk of care? Or is it all, it's all sort of private?
Thank you very much, Representative Josephson. That information is private and identified as health plan members. We have the authority and ability to access that information if we need to for a specific reason. But when you learn that the reporting that I get and the reporting that we insist on is to identify to the highest degree possible. So if we know, for example, if we're seeing a high cost commitment, we may know their age within a certain band, right? And age 60 to age 64, we may know their gender, and we may know some of the diagnoses, but that's it. If for some reason we need to understand more about the case or what's happened, or for example, if a member contacts us because we're having problems, processing a claim, or they need some assistance, then we might have a
those dollars effectively put into a lottery creators in anticipation of possible need. In other words, they just start funding something that may never be used if the employee remains healthy. But if it's sort of segregated and set aside, or how does that work?
To the chair, so just like any sort of insurance plan, every year our actuaries take a look at our experience. They want to make sure that and try to predict what our experience is going to be for the upcoming year, what they think the total cost for claims is going to be, how much we need to have a reserve because every health plan needs to have a reserve fund just in case premiums are insufficient to cover the cost of claims, as well as to try to moderate any sort of increases in premiums when they do. It's perfectly predictable, but when we recommend claims to easy premiums and look to our administrative costs. So annually, our actuaries review that and determine what they think the total amount will be, evaluate the employer contribution versus the employee contribution, discuss that in the employee stakeholder group called the Health Benefits Evaluation Committee, and then we use that to establish rates. So those are charged by the employer, essentially through payroll charges as part of the personnel cost based on bargaining units. Those funds are collected on essentially a bi-monthly basis, and they're put into a fund called the Brick Health Life Fund that is essentially set aside to pay out claims as they come in.
What if there was a wearable bi-monthly circumstance where obesity was going on? People were healthy, instead of a pandemic, we were all just wonderful. To be just the provider of rather moderate care than a particular, do they effectively lapse some of that back, or is it just a risk that they benefit from and enjoy the profit from? That makes sense.
Can I share everything I've just assumed? So, the Brick Health and Life Fund is a state account. So the monies that are collected from the health insurance for the investiture of life health insurance plan, they're not made in the state as far as any sort of amusements for claims. We've actually had what you've described occur pretty consistently. We've actually kept the employer contribution flat for the Alaskan employee plan for 5 years. That is half a decade without an increase in premiums, and we're very proud of that. And it was very challenging to do. While that occurred, we were also able to keep employee premiums relatively flat, although there were some differences for types of policy goals that we were able to achieve, and we put money back into the plan benefits. So in 2017, we had actually increased deductibles and out-of-pocket maximums for a year. When we experienced positive experience as a result of some of the new contracts we negotiated and some of the programs we implemented, we rolled those deductibles and out-of-pocket those deductibles back down. We have implemented things like co-pays for office visits that end up saving employees out-of-pocket costs. So when we're in a position where our claims are better than anticipated, what we've tried to do is work with our Health Benefits Evaluation Committee and think about the best ways to have that experience benefit with the employees and the employer using sort of flat employer contributions and some sort of benefit enhancement to the employee health insurance plans.
Moving forward, are we going to be able to maintain flat employee contribution levels, or do you anticipate a rise moving forward?
In the chair, I anticipate a rise moving forward. I think it's pretty lucrative to have flat health contributions for 5 years. I think moving forward, we should anticipate consistent increases. We will do our best to continually identify ways that, I think after this one win ways where we can save money and also benefit employees. And we will do our best to continue to leverage our contractual agreements to try to get the best pricing we can. But given what we're seeing with the rise of the drug costs, long. I do anticipate increases in the future.
All right, thank you. That's certainly understandable. Thank you very much for that presentation. So we are going to run until 1:15 today, and that would be just an absolute hard stop at 1:15. So we'll see how far we can get through this week's presentation in this time frame. I'm sorry, you need to continue. $1,000 compared to $1,900. That's the effect of Medicare.
So if you look at the graph on slide 14, you see the yellow box is the number of Medicare eligible. It's a percentage of the total retirement population that is Medicare age eligible. And you see that yellow box growing substantially from 2017 to 2021. So there's actually been a 10% increase, a 10% change in the makeup of the membership in the last 5 years, moving from members who are now Medicare eligible to members who are Medicare eligible. So what that means is overall costs for the plan on a per member basis are actually being offset as these members move into Medicare age eligible status. And we end up paying less for them on a per member basis.
That's the cost per beneficiary is much more when someone is Medicare eligible for two reasons. One, because that we're the secondary payer, but also because we can't pay more than the Medicare rate. Is that correct?
That's exactly correct. And the Medicare fee schedule is substantially more than what commercial insurance plans can negotiate.
Price results of those medical rates from the provider community.
We don't know. Either as long as I think that's an area that looking forward, the impact of Medicare and the proportion of our retirees who are Medicare eligible, I think we have a unique important role to play in looking at bigger ways that we can supplement the support Medicare from their retiree plan perspective. So, looking at slide 15, I'm not going to spend a ton of time on this, but essentially what this shows is looking at over the years, the pink line at the top are members in the plan, current members of the plan who are going to become for Medicare eligible. The dark blue dotted line on the bottom or the purple line are current members of the plan who are not Medicare eligible. So, you can see that as a population ages in the plan, members who are Medicare eligible is increasing, while those who are not are decreasing. And then looking out into the future, you see a similar trend where future Medicare members are increasing while pre-Medicare members are decreasing. So again, as we kind of look forward and think about what our role is and what our retirement population looks like, understanding how we supplement and support Medicare benefits is going to be more critical for the retirement plan than I think it has been in the past. So on slide 16, I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about this, but in 2019, the division implemented a new program where we can utilize a combination of federal monies and pharmaceutical drug discounts and rebates to offset the cost of prescription drug coverage. This is called an employer payer program. We were able to implement it in 2019, and it was a big win-win for us. It provided additional coverage for members who were able to expand certain vaccines to all members of the retiree population, but we were also able to benefit from additional federal subsidies. And if you look on slide 17, the amount of those federal subsidies is tremendous. In 2019, we actually received almost $50 million in federal, a combination of federal monies and pharmaceutical tax rebates coming back to the plan. And that has grown to almost $65 million as of 2021. So this is a very important program for the health plan. We view this as really probably our largest win-win in years, and it's something that we monitor very closely. Any sort of changes to Medicare Part D at the federal level we're tracking for their potential impact on the plan. Moving into slide 18. Well, we've taken some big steps to try to leverage those federal dollars and pharmacy rebates to offset the cost of prescription drug coverage. We are still facing some challenges, particularly related to specialty medication. So, this is probably a typical story if you talk to health plans that are exaggerated in the retiree plan because the retirees are older, they tend to take more prescriptions, and they make up in prescription drugs, make up a large portion of our overall spend. So, specialty medication represents almost 40% of retiree pharmacy spend, or about $110 million in 2020, and it represents just 1% of total prescriptions. And we are seeing a large increase in specialty medication costs. Those are associated with drugs that you're familiar with, Humira, Stelara, Opiate Magazine. Listen to the TV show, and you're going to hear some of those name brand drugs. Barrow was, as you know, making changes to the retiree plan, as well as a little bit fraught with peril, because things along with different elements are involved in that. But we have been successful from my perspective in making some important changes to the plan over the last 3 years through working with a board called the Retiree Health and Reorganization or Advisory Board. So we implemented the pharmacy program in 2019. That was successful in achieving savings for the plan, extending benefits for members. And in 2021, it is over for the board to implement this year. So it should, this is, I got the year wrong again. It should be 2022. I apologize. The industry for preventive care services. So as of January 1, 2022, retiree members have eligible state preventive care services available, including preventive colonoscopies. And we also implemented some additional clinical reviews of scheduled medications to try to address the rising costs that we saw in the last slide. So we're proud of the work that we're doing, and we are hopeful that it will allow us to be successful in future savings. And I know we're at about time, so I'm going to stop there. I don't think we need to address the rest of the slides in the presentation unless members have specific questions.
Are there any questions for these other guests here?
Yes, in a couple of sentences, how is it that in 2006, when the defined benefit system for NO3s ended, it was considered one of the main problems for healthcare costs? And now, 16 years later, our board is saying that part, the cost is it's only funded, but it's incredibly solid to bring it. What happened in that 16, 17 years?
Through the chair, a lot of work by a number of people to try to leverage some of the programs we talked about today, recognizing that we could leverage kind of discounts, negotiate better prices through contracts and purchasing power. Identifying different ways that we could leverage things like the federal equip program to improve our savings, and then the demographic effect of Medicare. I think the combination of that is what's put us in the place where we're at today for the health plan.
When members in the building are looking at new defined benefits, there's still the sense that there's no ability in including medical coverage for retirees. Is that the fact that we're seeing it now because of the reforms you've talked about? Or is that persist because it's the availability, I guess?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think there was a lot of unpredictability in the health plan. I know that we're in a position where we're bad where we were back in 2006. And I don't want to scare anyone by saying this, but if you have some large reforms in D.C. that change the nature of the subsidies that we receive through the Medicare Part D plan, those subsidies created almost $1 billion benefit to the accrued actuarial liability in 1 year. And if those were to significantly change or be removed, you're going to see that drop just as quickly. So there is a lot of people describe the health plan as dynamic, and I would say that if I can predict anything, it is that health insurance will continue to be dynamic as it did with the recovery plan.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for this presentation today. I really appreciate everything you and your whole team are doing to make sure that our state employees, dependents, retirees, and their own kind of have good health insurance that will cover the price that we can all afford. So I appreciate your hard work on that. This concludes our business for today. Our committee schedule for next week has been announced, but we'll have it via email, and of course, it'll be on basis at 4 p.m. on Thursday, I believe, with that this meeting. The House Special Committee, we